After quite a long wait, we're back with episode 33, Go Mountain Goats. I'm Finlay Wild, and I am joined today by Rob Greenwood, who I'm delighted to be getting interviewed by about my dark Bob Graham from January this year. Rob, well, I'll let Rob introduce himself.
I'm terrible at introducing myself.
I was going to come in with something, and then you sort of looked like you were going to speak. So go on.
All I was going to say, Finlay, is it's an honour to be interviewing you on your podcast on several levels, not least because much though I love listening to you interviewing other people, one of my favourite things is when you are interviewed on your own podcast. So to be the one interviewing is kind of a strange and surreal experience.
Great. No, it's... I thought it would be really good to get you on. Known you for quite a while as a friend, but also Rob. What's your official UKC title?
So UKC, I'm probably like the wearer of many hats. So primarily my role is actually relating to advertising. It's just bringing money in, which sounds really soulless, but there's a whole load more soul to it than that because you know, I'll get involved in writing articles. I guess I've interviewed you through UKC before. And as a sort of bit of background, I guess, on running and climbing, I've always had a sort of foot in both camps, really. I ran as a kid and I've always run, you know, through to my adult life. And for the last 4 years, probably been more of a runner than I have a climber. But from a climbing perspective, you can never take the climber out of the runner, I don't think, can you?
No, I don't think so. No.
So, yeah, a bit of both anyway. And obviously having a keen interest in things like big rounds and all the rest of it.
Great. Well, yeah, thanks for agreeing to chat to me.
Hey, no worries. Well, I guess, yeah, let's kick off with some questions. And, you know, the reason I initially got in touch, because I think I was going to interview you for UKC about the dark Bob Graham, because I just thought, that is a cool and very typically Finlay thing for Finlay to do. But then it obviously spiraled into this, which is great. And I guess, yeah, where do we begin? Because let's begin at Kendall Mountain Festival last year, where you let slip that you were going to do a winter Bob Graham. And the idea was that I think it was on the 21st of December, so the winter equinox, on the show,
22nd.
There you go. Yeah, it shows what I know, or how much I was listening.
I think it changes, it was the 22nd in 2023.
So the plan was you were going to go and do sort of hell or high water winter Bob Graham, and at the time, actually, I mean, like that, the 22nd came and went, and I didn't actually hear about how it had gone, and it was only after you successfully did it a little later. Earlier this year, in fact, that I realized that attempt maybe hadn't quite gone to plan. Although, I guess, yeah, do you want to tell us a bit more about the plan for that, you know, 22nd of December, winter equinox attempt?
Yeah, solstice, isn't it? Yeah, winter solstice.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I'm a really crap agent, Finlay.
I mean, obviously, I've been interested in these rounds for quite a while, and my summer Bob Graham was one of the hardest things I've done, fully supported, fully warm day, midsummer. I think it was, August, an amazing experience, of just like pushed me really hard to try and go as fast as I could to try and get the then record, that had, Killian Journey had, which I was, 7 minutes slower than him. So, it was still an incredible experience. Like I said, pushed me really hard. And then I've been interested, you know, I've done a lot of winter climbing and winter getting around the hills for a long time. So it was only natural that I was interested in doing, maybe a big round or something like this. But one of the real, I guess, issues for me was that, yeah, the conditions for like real classic conditions, they just don't come around very much. And bearing in mind that I live up in Fort William, so that my main experience of the changing seasons and different seasons, rather different winter seasons, is more in Scotland, so in Le Cabar and in Cairngorms. So I'm definitely not an expert on what the conditions are like regularly and can be like in the Lake District. But for whatever reason, I suppose different things were in my head, and I sort of came up with this thought of other people. Sorry, I'm rambling a bit. So I believe when the first winter Bob Graham and other big rounds were done, they tried to do it on the shortest day, so on the winter solstice, which is generally around 21st, 22nd December, and then things sort of it developed and changed since then. And to be perfectly honest, I sort of initially thought that was not maybe the greatest idea, because typically that's pretty early in the winter season, and in Le Cabar there wouldn't be much of a snow build up often. You'd be probably much better waiting till a good February sort of classic day where it was firm neve, and you could move fast and have pretty good conditions. But of course, those kind of classic conditions, they are becoming less frequent with climate change. So I kind of came back to the idea of actually doing it on a set day, because basically you'd just be waiting forever to get like the best conditions. And that was actually really good.
Yeah, I was going to say, and for you, was there a moment where you felt like you let go maybe of the possibility of doing it in the best winter conditions? Like as you say, like a nice bluebird day in February where there's, snow, neve underfoot, it's firm underfoot, it's like, nice and runnable and frozen and all the rest of it, versus, all right, I'm just going to set a date, and if it's absolutely awful, I'm going for it regardless. Was there a moment where you just shifted between one of those two, or do you just think?
Yeah, so I basically came back to that because I thought, well, that's something different. That's a challenge that I have never tried before, because all my big rounds have been like wait for a weather window. So this was like, it was actually pretty liberating to just go set this one date, and I'm just going to, obviously, I'm going to need to think carefully about what kit I take depending on the weather, but I'm just going to try whatever the weather is and try and get round. And then, so initially that was just within the 24-hour period of that shortest day. And then I was chatting to my friend Doogie, who generally likes to sort of challenge me. And he sort of threw this out there about, why are you going to start at like midnight, in the middle of the night on the shortest, coming into the 22nd? Like, why don't you, the whole thing about it, one of the things that makes it difficult is the lack of daylight. So he says, why don't you try and do it like fully in the dark? I was like, thought about this a bit, and then come up with this, sunset to sunrise idea. And I thought, well, how long is that? Okay, on the shortest day, flip that on its head, you've got the positive of it's the longest night, so you've got the most possible time, and that's 16 hours, 45 minutes. Which seemed, certainly pretty aspirational, but just possible enough that it was kind of worth considering. And I think that's what got me really inspired, because I had no idea if that'd be possible. And in a lot of conditions, it wouldn't be possible. But that kind of became the plan.
Do you find it's good to have a sense of humor about these things as you're doing it? As you're setting yourself a challenge?
Yeah, I mean, it's just running. I mean, yeah, I can just bail out and try again, or not. It's all meant to be fun, isn't it? Let's take a step back with everything that's going on in the world. We're running for enjoyment. It's meant to be. Good.
And it's also the challenge that you want out of it as well, because I think different people want different challenges from all these. Well, even from a single challenge like the Bob Graham, some people want to do it in summer, fully supported. Other people want to do it in winter on their own, exclusively in the dark. And both of those have merits. It's just, yeah, it's two completely different experiences from, in theory, the same thing underfoot.
Yeah, I think that's because particularly in winter, like it's apples and pears comparing different rounds. Like there's no two conditions that are going to be alike. You know, you might have, you know, powdery snow, but very mild. You might have no snow, which it was very mild on my first attempt. Or obviously you could have, you know, full on axe and crampons type conditions. So I felt like, yeah, doing it as this shortest day thing was quite a good way of not having to wait for the perfect conditions and just say, well, yeah, I'm not doing anything about the, how, you know, can't obviously do anything about how snowy it is, but I can sort of give myself that that challenge of the darkness factor and just pit myself against that. I also decided to just use map and compass, which, you know, has been the way I've done all of my running rounds. But I thought that would be an extra challenge to just know that I've got to rely on that and, you know, so use my night navigation. Obviously, I know the round fairly well, but still be a lot of places that you could potentially mess up.
Do you want to tell us a bit about how did that first experience go then of on the 22nd? You know, because the weather sounded fairly monumental from what you've suggested.
Yeah, so 20 seconds was the shortest day. So my run started at sunset on the 21st. So that was at 3:48 p.m., which is an odd time to start something like that at the best of times, but particularly when it was just clagged, it was quite claggy, really windy. To start with, it was really windy. It was really damp. And obviously, you know, it gets dark sooner when the weather's not so good. But it was definitely this real foreboding of going into it, thinking this is going to be tough. This is maybe not going to be fully enjoyable. I might not get round. But also, that was quite exciting because I was like, well, I'm just going to go and see. The forecast was due to get even worse. So basically, you know, as it, I guess, always is, number one thing was, you know, looking after myself, but that was particularly like acute in my mind because, you know, it's the middle of winter, like no one's out on the hill. It's going to be really windy and that's going to be really wet. And you know, there's like, I think I would go as far as saying that basically it's indefensible to be out. If you need to try and get rescued or something, you know, it's just, you couldn't really expect someone to come out and try it. It was just so minging. And I thought a lot about that beforehand, like with my kit and my contingency. But that was, to be honest, that was part of the draw. I just have to look after myself and just, that's it.
Remarkable how much bad weather you can endure if you have the right kit. But I guess the dilemma with these things when you're running it on your own is that, you know, when you are, you know, unsupported, you have to really balance how much kit you're taking because you want to take enough for it to be safe, but then not too much so that you're weighed down. And there's a really blurry line in between those two, isn't there? Because, yeah, on so many different grounds, be that like how much food you're carrying and, you know, the time you expect to take and the number of spare layers that you have and all the rest of it.
Yeah. And on a run like that, it was inevitable things were going to get, you know, wet eventually. It was just a matter of time. So it started out, it was really windy. The viz wasn't horrendous initially. But then later on, as I was getting higher up into, Beaufell, I mean, it was pretty, grim the whole way, but yeah, up into Beaufell and kind of the higher tops around Great End, it was just atrocious. Like it was the wind was blowing you over. You know, I had like loads of layers on and my goggles on. That is absolutely peeing it down with rain, kind of into my face. And obviously you got the head torch beam, but because you're up in the rain, you're in the mist, and you know, you could see maybe like 5 meters, and like trods that are big, big obvious like paths in the rock, when you can see them normally in the day or when they're dry, you just couldn't even barely make them out, because, you know, so the rocky trods, say at like Ill Crag and toward Great End, and you know, from there, just even just working out what was the huge main path was really difficult. And then obviously getting busted around and not, you know, not wanting to fall over, you know, fall over, sprain an ankle, etc. And gradually getting more layers on and things as it kind of got worse.
Yeah, because it, you know, all it takes is a sprained ankle, but things get pretty bad pretty quick. And at what point did you make the call then of, oh, hang on, this has got too stupid?
Yeah, I just got to the top of Scafell Pike, but like I'd actually been doing okay on my like sunset to sunrise, like 16-hour 45 schedule for the first like maybe 9 hours, and then like the next like section, which should take, I don't know, like an hour, took 2.5 or something. So it was just, you know, I kind of kept going, but I was starting to think, oh, this is just not really very sustainable. And yeah, so on the top of Scafell Pike, it was, you know, particularly heavy rain, and it was just absolutely hammering down on me, and I was getting blown around. And like I said, even finding a path, like the navigation had gone pretty well. But actually, yeah, just quite quickly, I was like, nah, you know, it's 3 a.m. It's like, nah, that's it. Like, and I suppose there was a factor of there's no way I'm going to get round, because obviously fairly soon after that, you do Scafell and then you get down into Wasdale for a bit of shelter. But then leg 4 would have been all into the wind. So it was looking very dubious. Like, you just can't put up with, you know, the wind. You've only got a sort of amount of time you can really deal with it. And I think, yeah, that was just the point. I was like, it's not going to happen. And my margins, you know, is thinner. So I still had like some spare kit, but I was basically wearing all my stuff. So I just said, nah, get out of here.
Yeah, abandon ship. Get back down to, where do you head down to, Seathwaite or such like, or do you go the other side actually? Because you're Keswick based.
I went to Seathwaite. Yeah, yeah. And actually, interestingly, around the same time, so Shane Oley, I knew about this. He told me when I met him to do an interview for the podcast a few months before. He'd said, I'm going to try. We'd had the same idea, basically, to do, we both wanted to do a shortest day solo unsupported map and compass, Bob Graham. So we've been a wee bit in communication about this. But he was going to stick to the midnight start, trying to do it within the 22nd of December. And he decided to go the other way around. So I went the typical clockwise. He went anti-clockwise to add to the kind of navigational part of it. So he'd started about 8 hours after me. And basically, he'd bailed out about the same time, o'clock, for 4 a.m. or whatever that was. And Rosie, my girlfriend, she had a tracker that, well, both the trackers, my tracker and Shane's tracker, so she could sort of see us both bailing off the route about the same time. He came down from Green Gable. We obviously had no idea how each other were getting on. So then he was a bit ahead of me, out to Seathwaite, and she sort of picked him up, and I think both of us were, Shane was prepared to just be jogging back to Keswick. I was prepared to just be like walking on the road, because I wasn't expecting to get picked up, just walking along the road, keeping warm until whenever I could get a lift or she could come and get me in the morning. But yeah, then Rosie appeared at like 6 or half 6 or something in the morning and picked us both up. So that was a really, really fun to sort of chat that through, you know, both sleep, all of us sleep deprived because Rosie had been up as well. And yeah, get back to Keswick and sort of a debrief, I suppose, on the decisions we'd made and what the weather was like. It was, turns out it was crazy windy and wet for Shane too.
Yeah, yeah. Who thought the Western Lakes weren't any more sheltered than the Eastern Lakes then? You know, you mentioned map and compass, and I guess like you do know the route well. So I guess there's maybe an element of being on autopilot. But what you've also said is the fact that, you know, actually some of these trots you think you know really well. So all you need is the clag to be down a bit. And as you say, something just to look different, you know, the way that the head torch shines off of wet rock or something like that for it to look a little different. And those trods don't look anywhere near as obvious as they might. So do you want to tell us a bit about your, you know, how did you find out with like map and compass? Do you have a percentage of time, do you reckon, that you're on autopilot versus actually like, you know, properly thumb down following a bearing?
Yeah, good question. And I guess, well, loads of things. Yeah, there were some parts of the route that I hadn't done for about 2.5 years. So they've obviously faded in the memory. There were some parts I'd done much more recently. And I think, you know, the trods, you know, the Lakeland runners will know better than me, but the trods are much more developed, much more, developed than they had a lot more traffic than they would have 10 or 20 or however long ago, years ago. So, when you're on the right trod and you recognize it as the right trod, that's pretty useful. That's pretty good. I think I've got a pretty good eye for, you know, for just my sort of geospatial awareness of where I am and knowing a trod. And the other thing is quite a lot of it's fairly easy navigation. And knowing the summits, like remembering the summits and which cairn is the definitive one, because I've definitely have all those cairns kind of etched in my mind from doing my bob before. So that's really good because you're sort of, you know, when you hit it, when you see it, you know which summit it is. So when the viz wasn't horrendous, I was still on the first attempt. Yeah, I was still on the compass sort of most of the time. Like double checking, because the worst thing you want to do is think you're in the right spot and then be heading off just through laziness, basically. So, or laziness is maybe a bit harsh because you've got a lot of other stuff to do. You've got to eat and drink and keep going.
Maybe it's more than just other things. It's not laziness, as you say, but the problem is that if you're tired, it's more just that your attention wanes. And then the next thing you know, you look up and you're like, oh no,
yeah,
I've done something silly here.
But I mean, where from leg one and two weren't too bad on the bad weather one, and from leg three, basically it was kind of, apart from maybe the first part of leg three, it was basically full concentration on the compass and on the navigation. There's little bits where I'm definitely on the right trod, but then up around Beaufell, you know, it was, I basically stopped eating and drinking much because I was just, you just couldn't really, you were just taking everything to make progress, which was slowing despite that.
And have you ever used a GPS watch of any description? Is that like something, do you own one? Have you ever had a play about with one? Or
so I suppose, like I have the, you know, I get a trace of where I've been, and I suppose that's GPS, but in terms of following a trace, not really. Maybe in a sky race where they sort of had put out a GPX file. In some schemo stuff I'd done, like I did some big rounds on my skis in the Cairngorms a couple of years ago, and they were like, you know, like starting at midnight and things like that. And for that, I kind of decided there's a whole lot of other stuff going on that actually I was going to allow myself GPS because I don't want to ski off a cliff in the dark. You know, there's the, yeah, that was, for me, that seems sort of different and justifiable, and other people would have different views on that. But not really, not for any sort of UK running, really.
I mean, I'm not like a GPS disbeliever by any means. I've used GPSs on, you know, some things, and I've used map and compass a lot more recently, just because I think on, again, it's a personal thing, but I've just enjoyed the challenge of going out and using map and compass. I think as well that, since nobody actually is listening to know my thoughts, but I'll tell them anyway. But, you know, with map and compass, I think you get a far greater appreciation of the land that you're running through. And the, you know, the landscape, because you have to look at the map as a whole. Whereas when you're following like a GPS, you know, trail on your watch, I think it is much more like that following the breadcrumb trail, and you don't necessarily get that same sort of holistic view of the landscape. Or maybe I'm just talking out my arse there, but that's my take on it, basically. I'll probably continue doing a blend of the two. It's just as of when, you know, one works, sometimes the other works better others. But it definitely adds, I would say, to the challenge, simply because, you know, with a watch on, you can just, in theory, look at it and just keep moving really efficiently. Whereas with a map and compass, maybe, you know, there are seconds here and seconds there, maybe, that are taken out, which, you know, I guess, what I'm saying here is, I guess, like, you know, coming on to your next attempt where, you know, you went on to go and take the winter solo unsupported record, you know, I think that makes it all the more impressive to me because of the fact that there's a few factors that you put in, such as navigating with map and compass, such as doing it overnight, that probably proactively made it more awkward for you to get the record. But again, I think we've covered why you did that, and that's because, you know, it's just a laugh, isn't it?
I wanted to do it for a challenge that I didn't know the outcome of. I mean, there's loads of things, because obviously solo unsupported on site would be, you know, would also be way harder. So if you're doing a mountain marathon and you just get the map thrust at you at the start, obviously you haven't recce'd the area. I had basically had a really good recce from my failed attempt because I'd been out basically halfway along it. I'd imagine that if you've had a good recce and you know a line, that's probably always going to be faster than following a line on a watch, unrecce'd, I would imagine. I don't know how effective it would be to run really fast for just following a line with no other knowledge of the route.
Maybe that's it. Wrecking trumps everything, I think.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're maybe some world-class orienteer and able to move through things way quicker than I am. But yeah, I think wrecking trumps everything.
Great, yeah. And I'll just be out for, you know, if I'm out for just training or whatever, and I, like, it's not like I won't look at, you know, the dot on your OS maps on your phone, you know, sometimes I'll do that. But in terms of, so that's while training or just out for fun. But yeah, absolutely wasn't going to do that on this thing. So I had, you know, I had my phone switched off, and the idea was, no, I'm going to just go out and make some mistakes, but have to just correct them and find my way, you know, regardless. So that was fun. That was a good, it inspired me to have that challenge.
Yeah, it's the willingness to actually accept, to have mistakes, basically, I think is a really underrated thing. I think Strava's almost ruined that in some ways, because it's allowed people to look at things afterwards when, like, post-match analysis can be so much more public and so much more brutal if you do mess up, either just, you know, in a race or on a big round or something. You know, it's a very public display afterwards, isn't it, as to, like, what went wrong.
And it's just so easy in bad weather, you know, to go wrong. Because when you're running, you're particularly when you're racing, you've gone a long way before, you know, in a minute or two. And if you've just gone a bit the wrong way, I actually went slightly the wrong way in Jura, 2023, between the third Pat and Coravin, which wasn't really a major issue, but, you know, I was sort of running off memory on that and didn't come off the track quite early enough. And yeah, it was fairly minimal, but you just, I think you never get immune to these errors. Like, yeah. Everyone makes errors, especially when your concentration goes elsewhere for a few seconds, even it can be.
So what we're saying here, Finley, is recce it basically, because that's the best. But then when actually you're in the heat of the moment in a race, there's a distinct possibility that your brain is just going to eject the SD memory card that had the relevant data on. And you may well just freestyle and go the wrong way anyway.
Yeah, I'd love to do something. I'm running out of sort of mountain ranges in the UK, but I'd love to do like a solo unsupported on site on somewhere that I've never been, and really just get handed a map of a round. Maybe McGillicuddy's Reeks. I've never been there. That's in south of Ireland. I don't know too much about it, but I'm going to keep it that way and see if there's something there to be done.
Is that why, I'll bring this back around full circle in a second, but is that why, things like the Rigby round, I think, are so much fun? Because, the style in which you've got to do it is intertwined with, the round itself. You've got to climb it. You've got to do it, on site. And I can't remember whether it says solo or in pairs, but it's, minimalist, isn't it? Obviously, solo unsupported.
Yeah, so the 18 Cairngorms, 18 Munros of the Northern Cairngorms, solo unsupported on site is the sort of the idea with it, and yeah, there's on site and there's on site, isn't there? Because obviously, if you live in the Highlands, you'll have been in the Cairngorms. Not necessarily, but if you're a runner who lives in the Highlands and you've been in the Cairngorms, obviously you'll have seen some of the Rigby round. But I take that to mean really you haven't gone out and specifically recced the routes of the Rigby rounds, because you do some slightly unusual crossings between different Munros that you wouldn't do on shorter days. But I love that exists out there as just a challenge for people. It's not for everyone. Some people might not be confident with their navigation or might not be fussed about that aesthetic. But I've spoken to a lot of people who are pretty inspired by that. And I think it's great that exists.
Yeah. So yeah, to bring that full circle, then back to the Bob Graham, anyway. Ground that you've trodden before, obviously back in December on the 21st, 22nd, and then in January. Do you want to tell us a bit about your successful round then? Like, how was it in comparison? Because if I recall correctly, it was the opposite of the day that you had in December weather-wise.
Yeah, exactly. So when I had this idea, that when I set off to do the solstice one, I hadn't really thought of what am I going to do if I don't get round or if it fails. I just thought, well, I'm going to try, and it doesn't matter if it fails. Like, it's just a run. It'll just be an experience that'll be interesting, whatever happens. But then as a couple of weeks went by, I guess I had put in, I was still out for like 14 hours on the failed attempt. I'd like put in quite a lot of effort, but I had the experience. But at the same time, I maybe, I didn't have a sort of finished product to show for it. So then I did start thinking about, okay, well, the nights are getting shorter now, but I could look at the calendar and see how late could I potentially do it and get round, because I gained a bit of confidence about how fast I could potentially move when it's dark but good weather. So there was a weather window coming up on the 6th of January, so I had to look at some charts, and yeah, I had 15 minutes less darkness, if that makes sense. Sunset and sunrise had changed, so this time I was starting at 4:03 p.m. Obviously, it's not totally dark at sunset, but yeah, that's when I started. So I had a little bit less time to play with, but was a bit more confident in good weather. And whereas the first one had been really mild and really stormy, this one was, I think it wasn't crazy cold. It was like -2 on the top of Scafell Pike. But I knew that there was hardly any snow around or ice around, really. There was some there was quite a bit of sort of hoarfrost. It was made for slippy rocks up in the sort of rocky part of the second half of leg 3 and some of the parts of leg 4. But I also, you know, I've been on that kind of terrain, you know, it's similar to the top of like Ben Nevis and, you know, the Annex and things. Well, not so much the Annex, but yeah, Ben Nevis, let's say. So I kind of can move around on that terrain. So yeah, it was very different, and the weather, it was only a sliver of moon, but there was basically hardly any wind, and it was looking like it was a bit unclear as to was there going to be fog. I sort of had this feeling that actually it's going to be good weather, and yeah, it ended up being, it was basically the only fog I hit was coming back into Keswick, like in the last 5 minutes of the round. And it was clear skies. It was still dark, but yeah, very different experience. And suddenly, again, who would have thought it? Much easier to go faster without the incessant wind and rain.
Yeah. It turns out running in better weather is a nicer experience. And do you think, though? I mean, jokes about that, though, but it did sound like the first, you know, the first attempt that you made, though, was, I don't know, I mean, the way you're describing it, I mean, it does sound awful, but it does sound like a positive experience in some ways. Am I misreading that, you know, in
terms? Oh, no, it was definitely, it was a really, yeah, it was a really valuable experience for me. Like, it was, yeah, it was really bad weather. It's probably not the worst weather I've been out in, but it was certainly up there in the top 5, and certainly the worst weather I've been out in on my own. Yeah, it was really serious conditions, but that kind of is, I think, what made it all the more sort of valuable is, you know, I'd been around the hills a lot. I've not done a huge amount of night navigation in really bad weather, so I was really pleased with how that went. I wasn't perfect. I made some mistakes. Sergeant Mann, weirdly, I kind of didn't take the best lines to find that. I lost some trods, and it wasn't too bad, but that was a bit of a stressful period. And the top of, Great End. Just navigation around there, yeah, it was pretty difficult. But yeah, it was definitely a positive experience. I really like have some great memories from that. But it was pretty full on.
Yeah. It wasn't conventional type one, you know, real time enjoyment. Anyway, did my round saying that you lost a compass somewhere around? Was it on your successful attempt? And. You did actually have a backup with you, but do you want to just, you know, going back to, we've talked a bit about safety margins, you know, obviously just the fact that you had a spare, because, you know, that again could have just marked the end of the attempt there and then had you not have had one. So.
Yeah. I think, yeah, one of the things I've, with like race vest pack type things that not all the pockets are zipping closed, and gloves, and it just doesn't seem and bad weather just doesn't seem a particularly good combination sometimes. So yeah, but actually I lost my goggles on the first attempt because they were steaming up and I had them on the top of my head and they must have fallen off at some point in the wind. But yeah, on the successful one, when it was quite nice weather, I hadn't actually used my compass very much, but it was in one of these pockets and it just must have sort of fallen out at some point, which is obviously a totally stupid error when you're trying to do something map and compass. I think I really like a thumb compass, but I think probably that's the change I would make if I was doing something like that again, is that like they're great when you're on your thumb, but there's nothing really attaching it when it's not on your, when you're not using it, when it's not on your thumb. So, whereas a spare, you know, typically you could have it around your neck or tied to something. So, my spare was just a normal small compass, and I'd sort of almost thought about not taking it. And then I've been like, no, you need like belt and braces. You need like real confidence in your head torch, like batteries, and you need two maps and two compasses. And, I decided I needed like a tracker emergency SOS thing. So I borrowed, there's different types, what they call PLBs. There's different pros and cons to them, which I thought a bit about, but I decided to take an InReach Mini, which I got lent from my friend Ben, which meant that it would send out like a tracker thing every 10 minutes, but also I could, text out a phone switched off as a backup as well. And it links to that, so you can actually text with it. And you can do, there's an emergency button on it as well for, you know, it would really have to be, well, yeah, it's an emergency button. So I had that.
Sorry, after you carry on.
No. And yeah, I thought pretty carefully about, you know, what type of layering and clothes and, blizzard bags I've been carrying in winter for quite a few years now, particularly when I'm on my own. So it's like, it's an insulated sort of multi-layer thing. So it's not just like a small foil bag. It actually has a bit of warmth to it. Now I've not used it myself in Extremis. I mean, it's not going to be comfortable, but, I believe they're much better than, you know, than just a foil bag or a plastic bag. They actually have a warmth rating to them. So I've got one of them, but I actually decided for this to borrow one that's like an over the head, like a smock, like a jacket. Cause I thought, well, you know, probably slightly more likely. I mean, anything could happen, but I could just get really cold. And then, so at least with that, I could put it on and walk out. Whereas obviously the blanket is good if you're sort of just lying there, but, yeah, so I had.
I've forgotten who did the video, but there's a really good video. It's filmed up in Scotland, you know, featuring three sets of runners. One using, I think it's just actually nothing. I think they're just running in the kit. The other using FRA mandatory kit, and the other using like Blizzard bag and the full works. And basically, it's like real time film of them basically getting colder and colder. And the person who hasn't got anything, I think it may have even been using FRA mandatory kit as well, they're getting pretty cold pretty quick. And the people who've got things like, you know, the, you know, it's actual proper survival bag or blizzard bag are actually like relatively comfortable. But as runners, I think we can all be guilty, can't we, of actually packing very little, because when it all goes right and it all goes well, we're back really quickly. And everything's fine. And, you know, we stay nice and warm because we're generating lots of body heat. But when things go badly, you know, I think many of us could be quite guilty of not packing enough.
If you need to stop, you don't have enough, basically. You won't have enough. Yeah, it's really worth a watch. I think you can find it on Ian Stewart's YouTube. What's his, is it Trail Running Scotland? Sorry, Ian, we can put the link in the notes, but it's, also on, Mountaineering Scotland have a Think Winter campaign, and it's got lots of issues. There's even, lots of info. There's even a specific winter running section on that, which is pretty interesting. And I think it's on there as well. And you're right. Yeah, it was race minimum kit. And then it was a step up to more like a kind of standard bag. And it was the blizzard bag was the kind of third step. And they just sat there and sort of saw how long it took to get cold.
It's really good because it's such a visual example of how bad it would be really pretty quick. So, where do we round things up anyway with the dark Bob Graham then? I mean, you did get the record. Do you want to tell us a bit about that as well? And I know that you were double checking with Kim on Strava as to whether or not that was indeed the record.
Yeah. So like I said, the failed attempt gave me sort of a bit more confidence that in good weather I could actually do my 16 hours 30 that I'd need to do to get around between sunset and sunrise. But I also thought there was a bit of a chance that I could potentially match Kim's record, which was 15 hours. It's just going out of my head. Anyway, probably doesn't matter talking about it exact times, but I was, about 15 and a half hours. I'll put this in the show notes as well. So I had the splits for doing it just in my original plan of just in darkness. But I also had the Kim's splits as well. I couldn't resist taking them because initially I considered whether I was going to go no watch at all. So I didn't even have an idea of like what time of night it was. And then I sort of thought, well, I don't know if that particularly makes it sound that much better. And actually it would be really useful to have some split times, particularly if I'm trying to and get the winter record. So yeah, so I took Kim's splits, and actually I managed to get up on them initially, but then I felt kind of odd. I felt in say leg two, I felt a bit weird, possibly slightly lonely, maybe. And that, so you get that anyway, because you know physiologically everyone else is tucked up at home. It's getting dark. You know you're not going to see many people, and you've got a long night ahead, and you know your core body temperature goes down, you know, as it gets into the middle of the night, things like that. So there was that sort of foreboding of going into the night, but also I was like, oh, I'm ahead of Kim's split, so basically it's all to lose. Like there's so many places where I could mess up the navigation just a little bit, and every time I get a little gust of wind, it wasn't windy, but occasionally in exposed spots you'd get a little gust of wind. And this would sort of give me a little throwback to the previous attempt, and a little shudder of, you know, how tough that was. So I felt a little bit sort of apprehensive and like under pressure. And I basically had, this was going on for a while, and I basically had to just chat to myself and internally just say, look, you might mess up, but you know, you can't do anything about that apart from concentrate, run your own race. So I sort of switched off from his splits a bit in the middle, and just focused on making good decisions and making good progress. And it was pretty slidey. I decided not to take Axe or Micro Spikes or anything, because I had pretty good information that there basically was hardly any. There was no neve, basically, or very, very little. And there was quite a lot of hoarfrost and slippy rocks up high on, like I said, Scafell kind of Great End area. But that's felt I could deal with that, because there's no like really steep slopes that you have to come down up high where it would be like that. Similarly, I wondered about wearing some like orienteering spikes. Dobbs, but I decided against. And yeah, it was a bit slippy, but I just basically had to be as efficient as I could. And then later on into leg four, I could really start looking at the splits again and thinking, okay, yeah, you're still on them. Okay, try and now push on a bit and get a little bit of a buffer. But it wasn't much. I think I had about 12 minutes of a buffer, 12 minutes ahead of Kim at the end.
You're in the right place to think about it, like midway through leg four, whereas on leg two, it was like too soon in the experience to start thinking about it. It's also, I don't know, I guess like, you know, that difference in between feeling chased or being the chaser. And I suppose you probably had in leg two, you felt chased by the outline of Kim Collison's record.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It was really quite, nice. My like I said at the start, my summer BG was amazing. like one of my one of my best running experiences. But it was also like so mentally hard to be like pushing so hard and to be always just that bit behind Killian. So it's quite nice on this to not be pushing quite so hard. I mean, it was harder in some ways, obviously the nav and the carrying everything, you know, much heavier bag. I didn't have a bag for my supported one. But yeah, there was I didn't have to kind of kick myself for getting behind the splits if I'd, you know, one of the splits, say, between Great End and Ilcrag or whatever, was quite slidey and I wasn't as fast as I would have hoped. I thought, oh, it's okay. I'm still kind of where I need to be.
Did it feel like you were doing the same thing as you did back in May 2018? You know, did it feel like you were doing the same as when you were doing the Bob?
That was, yeah, it was 2021. But yeah. 21. Yeah, no. I mean, it was great to be back and run around that route. And it, actually, I really, it reminded me how great a route it is. It was, yeah, I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed leg four, which typically would be my like best kind of terrain, but I wasn't really able to enjoy on my summer bob because I was so gassed. So yeah, it felt like a, you know, okay, it's the same route, but it felt like a very different experience. But at the same time, I could sort of think back to, you know, whoever was with me on my supported one and different, you know, different things or slight route variations. Because it's quite sensory deprivation in the dark there. Okay, I had a good head torch and you've got that pool of light, but that was something to deal with as well, I suppose, just being on your own in the dark, basically without, you know, you don't have the kind of views. You could make out the distant mountain views, and it was cool to see, you know, the lights of some of the towns, see stars. It was really weird going past Dunmail and seeing the cars going past when I'm in the middle of this thing. But yeah, it was nice to think back to the memories from times I've been there before.
Really is night and day, so many different ways as well, both in terms of actually night and day, but also people and, you know, the support. And it must have been crazy that day, a whirlwind, I've no doubt. But, you know, obviously then that completely contrasting with you alone at night on your Todd. I mean, I doubt you saw a single other human being, did you, from beginning to end?
I saw quite a lot of tents, quite a lot of people camped out in different spots. There's a couple of people beside tents, but not really any interaction. No. Until like Portinscale on the road in the morning.
Hey, something we haven't really covered as such. I mean, we touched on it briefly, but just, you know, is it worth us just talking a bit about what a winter round is and what a midwinter round is and what exactly that entails?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really good thing because, as I said, as I was saying at the start, I used to think, okay, I'm just going to wait for like the classic Ramsey round conditions because that's, you know, the most aesthetic time to do it. But the reality, we just don't get those conditions very much. I'm not saying we're never going to get them, but it's just so rare that also the chance of you being off and being able to go for it and the weather being, you know, good, it's just pretty rare. So, yeah, there's various thoughts on this. So I suppose the first thing is, well, winter is loosely defined, isn't it, as the 3 months between the start of December and the end of February. There's a different definition, which I hadn't heard, which Anna Wells is using, who's doing a Monroe round, a winter Monroe round at the moment, which is between the solstice and the, I think, 3 months after the solstice. Is it the lunar winter?
Yeah, you know my difference between equinox and solstice. Finlay, so much, you know, this isn't really valid.
It's just gonna be me rambling then. then there's the sort of the idea of like the midwinter period, which is Martin Stone has written about defining the midwinter, and it's in the Fjällräven magazine, but essentially 3 weeks around the shortest day, 3 weeks around the solstice, which, you know, obviously you're going to be guaranteed a lot of darkness. And I do like the idea of that as being like a reproducible thing. So we can't, well, you could never reproduce the same conditions as someone else, but particularly now with our wildly fluctuant weather, it's very hard to kind of directly compare winter rounds, because everyone's going to get different conditions, and that's great because everyone has their own experience. And I think, in fact, that's a strength, because we can all discuss, oh, what was it like for you? What was this bit like? Yada, yada. Different challenges based on, you know, different conditions. So like for me, the winter, you know, like snow and ice aspect wasn't really too bad. And on the second one, the weather wasn't too bad. Whereas, say, I had a lot more darkness than most people would typically have. Although I suppose if you're doing a 24-hour round, you'd have that darkness and some daylight as well.
You almost need to go back and do it again, Finley. So you've got the wet one, you've got the dry one, and now you need the snowy one, maybe.
Yeah. I'd love to. I think that would be great for a whole load of other reasons. But so I like that reproducible nature of, okay, you are having the maximum darkness. And yeah, I don't suddenly expect loads of people are going to do this, because actually you need to be, you know, for a lot of people, just getting round in 24 hours in summer is, you know, that's a great challenge. There's not that many people that could probably get round in 16 hours 45 is the maximum amount of darkness you can have. But it'd be cool if someone had to go at some point.
There's bound to be someone else out there. Kim Collison.
Yeah.
There must be like sort of in the blocks ready and waiting to go, I think. Or maybe now that everyone's done the spine race, maybe next year we'll be having
a big
year for big rounds. Because you know, Jack Scott's got to, you know, put his efforts somewhere, and you know, this seems like as good a bad idea as any.
Yeah, that's next level in terms of the length, but the conditions. And but I suppose there's some similarities, isn't there, like running whatever the weather, because it's an organized race that starts on a certain day. I guess I'm one of the things I'm most proud about with this round is just that I think I thought carefully about equipment and being self-sufficient, and obviously anyone can have a trip and hurt their ankle and need help. But like throughout the whole thing, I was just very conscious of needing to look after myself and have appropriate kit and sort of contingency, margins. So I feel like that side of it went really well, and like it didn't feel reckless at any point.
And did you spare a thought whilst you were over the tops for Martin Stone? Because one of my favorite Go Mountain Goats episodes is Martin, his voice recording after he did the first ever, I think it was, solo, unsupported, winter Bob Graham. Yeah. And the thoughts of him and the amount of kit he was carrying and those big handheld, you know, torches that he was using. Did you spare a thought for Martin across the tops at all?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Martin's episode, like he had, it sounds like, yeah, like the weather wise, like it sounds much more wintry than I got. I love talking to Martin about these things. His memory of, you know, his rounds, but also other people's rounds is fantastic. And he was one of the first people I spoke to kind of in the few days after my round, just to kind of share the enthusiasm, because I knew he'd be interested. And definitely thought of him kind of trailblazing with his, he had like four torches, and the kit is so different, but it's sort of that standing on the shoulders of giants thing, isn't it? Like everyone has sort of taken from, okay, what's been done before, and then that becomes the starting point for the next person to take it on. And that's that, yeah, definitely as it should be. And it's great that people are interested in this kind of stuff.
Are we allowed to ask what next? Is that a question that's permitted? It's a really unimaginative one, but you know, I'm sure you've got a few fun things up your sleeve throughout 2024. So are you allowed to tell us any?
Yeah, definitely. I'm not crazy secretive. I guess I don't see the point in sort of going on too much about stuff before you've done it. But I am keen for this year to be, I think there's, as hopefully has come across in this interview, like doing these big adventures with unknown outcomes is really, I find that really rewarding. So I'm probably moving to do more of that kind of stuff, hopefully, this year. So as I said last year, I'd like to get my Tranter round record back, summer Tranter. I think, yeah, that's still on my cards, but other stuff too. Oh, there's loads. I'd love to get out for a proper blast on the Coolin round. Like to also maybe try and run a bit further than I've done before. And yeah, I'd quite like to have a look at the 24-hour Munro record. But that's, yeah, obviously a step up in distance, and it's just, you know, so therefore like takes longer to recover. So I think like the timing of when you got to fit that in is quite interesting.
The dilemma you face, Finlay, is that you run you know, like for most of us who are doing the Bob Graham round or these big rounds in 24 hours, you're doing it in sort of 12 or 13 hours, and so you're effectively, you know, you're just looking to bring actually the amount of time up to what we're usually running these big rounds at, but you just got to go twice as far.
Well, I think, yeah, like I've not run for, yeah, hopefully just under 24 hours.
Yeah,
52, that'll be all right. So yeah, I kind of have yet to experience that. I'd like to. So there's kind of stuff like that. And also, I'm going to go out to the Alps with my skis in April, and see if I can have a look at some faster stuff there. But I basically will just see what conditions are like and what's kind of looking possible. But a few ideas of things I'd like to try and do some fast times or fast British times on kind of mountain stuff there.
And have you got dreams of going back to the Bob in summer? Again, is that a sort of thing that you feel like you want to embrace? Because obviously since your last effort in, was it 2021, do you say? I said 2018. that charming American man came along and did an exceptionally good time. So he's made it somewhat more challenging than it was before. And it was challenging enough before. So any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think probably like I've said elsewhere, like when I had like 7 minutes to make up to get to Killian's record, that was quite tempting. Not initially. Initially, I thought that I'm spent. That's me buried myself. But then gradually, I thought, well, it was a pretty hot day, and you know, I could do this and that slightly differently. But then obviously, Jack took another 30 minutes off that. So it's like a 5% improvement I'd need to make on my time, which is massive. I wouldn't totally rule it out, but I think I'm much more psyched for other stuff. And I think maybe if things were like going really, really well, and I thought, oh, I am actually up a notch from where I was, then could be potentially cool to try it all again. But I think that would just, something would have to bring that feeling on. I don't really feel like I really want to train up to that level to try and get that. I mean, it's not my like classic, it's not my strongest terrain. It's not my home place or my my home country. But it is a cool round.
Yeah, I think if I'm reading the room right, I think the dilemma that you would have is that you really like going and doing a lot of stuff, you know, like these challenges and just sort of like the adventure of it. And the problem would be is if you did want to go back and do that, you'd have to kind of put all your eggs in one Bob Graham based basket, and that would have to become your everything. And the problem with that is that, well, yeah, be intense, wouldn't it? And it wouldn't, it would mean that you'd have to sacrifice quite a lot of other fun stuff in order to get that potential thing to be a thing, which even then would, like you say, be a you know, tough call.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's other places where maybe I could I'm closer, I'd be more likely to get my record back from Jack in the Tranter, say. That would be tough, but I much more focused to try and get that first.
Well, good luck. I look forward to seeing how you get on with all of those. And thanks for joining us, the avid fan base, on your own podcast.
No, I mean, it's obviously great to have you agree to come and do this. You know, it's pretty late on a Wednesday night. It's been fun, and it's great having the podcast that I can just chat about the stuff I love doing. So, thanks for chatting.
Cool. Cheers, Finley.
Cool. Well, it's outro time. Thanks everyone for listening. This has been episode 33. Thanks to Rob Greenwood. I'm Finley Wild, and see you next time.